Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
So we're going to get started. I'm here today. My name is Claire Iwasaki. I'm a host with the Chinese Studies New Books Network channel. And I'm here with Carlos Piocos, who's a professor in the literature department at De La Salle University. He's published widely on gender and transnationalism in a number of international peer-reviewed journals. And his monograph, which we're talking about today, Narratives, Affect, and Politics of Southeast Asian Migration, was published by Routledge in 2021. He's also edited and translated a collection of Indonesian migrant women's fiction from Bahasa Indonesia to Filipino, and he received his PhD in comparative literature from Hong Kong University. So Carlos, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to me today.
Thank you for inviting me, Clara.
So I guess just to get us started, can you talk a little bit about what led you to this book project? How did you become interested in this topic?
So this book is actually based on my dissertation. Initially, when I was proposing for my research project for my PhD, I have a completely different project. It's supposed to be about Southeast Asian speculative fiction and nationalism. So, that's how different the whole project took shape because of my encounter and immersion with migrant Filipinos in Hong Kong while I was there. So, and particularly when they get to introduce me to also the Indonesian migrant community, where I stumbled into materials, writings of Indonesian migrant women workers. So it got me into thinking about looking at their works first and reflecting on some of my experiences working with these migrant women from two communities. And I guess it led into that. I began to seriously consider taking and studying Bahasa Indonesia while I was doing my PhD dissertation, enrolling in some classes, and then led me into looking at materials that reflects on Filipino experiences in migration. And I guess it led into this project wherein I tried to archive all of these cultural materials and try to make sense of them, and looking at them from a perspective that would allow me to have a sort of comparative examination of their experiences and how they articulate it through an emerging cultural production called migration. So it also made me ask about what kinds of texts or what kinds of literatures and cultural production are being examined in researches in humanities. And I was wondering how much of this kind of study would contribute to that, given that we are looking at writers or women writers who are not part of the canon or even not part of the kinds of texts that we usually look into when we talk about diaspora, migration. So this all of these questions led me into looking at this project and pursuing it as my dissertation, and then later on transforming it into this book that we're talking about right now.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. I really like, I like all of it, obviously, but I like the point about canonicity, right? This idea that, you know, this stuff exists and yet somehow we don't, it's never really talked about that much. Okay, so, you know, as you mentioned, right, this book does emerge out of a dissertation project. You know, at some point I'd love to read that original dissertation project, but maybe you're over that. But I'm just kind of curious, you know, what are some of the challenges, you know, that you faced in converting a dissertation project to a book?
I think the most significant challenge for me was going back to the dissertation and looking at the amount of changes in the political landscape that happened when I after I defended the dissertation, before I was, and after I defended the dissertation, and then the full 3 or 4 years that I got a book contract, and I would have to revisit the manuscript and rewrite it again because there were several political changes that happened in the Philippines as well that are very relevant to the way I framed some of the discussions in the chapters, particularly with basing some assumptions with social media responses, because many of the narrative, I start the chapters at the outset with narratives about how popular sentiments gets to reflect some of the contradictions that I was trying to explain in each of the chapters in terms of policies, in terms of the experiences of migrant women themselves in the writing. It is a challenge because of how those social media responses have been distorted in the past few years because of this whole politics of disinformation and this, what they're calling us, a post-truth era, and a lot of the Filipino migrants have been active agents of that. So what's interesting for me, looking back at my experiences when I was doing my dissertation, was the year that my last few months in Hong Kong was in early 2016, which is the early months of campaign period for the last national election, where a very popular president came about. And I witnessed that kind of change among some of the people I immersed with, because I saw how popular our president was, our outgoing president was back then in Hong Kong. And a lot of those popularity came from very distorted ideas spread in the internet. So when I was revisiting the text, and when I have to reframe and revise all of the things that refer to social media responses and responses in internet that refers to some of the experiences of migrant workers because of that politics. And I begin to question as well some of the ways that I assume how influential certain discourses are. And I think that is the most challenging issue for me. But I just have to confront that problem and then try to go back to what really is the core and the primary text that I'm looking at. And it's still the texts that are generated by this by migrant women. So that's one of the challenges. And I guess that also dovetails to another challenge, which is looking at how much of the materials needs to be updated, how much of these discourses that I put out have changed in the past few years. So, yeah, I think there are many parts of it are rewritten. It's not completely different from the dissertation, but a substantial part of it was changed and revised and rewritten to become the book that it is now.
Yeah, such a rich answer. It is, I think it really highlights in a lot of ways, right, the kind of challenges of doing something that is so timely, right? That if you are doing something so timely, then it's kind of a moving target, and this does need to, you know, you need to put in a lot more work than, you know, I work on a lot of people who are dead. So there's not that much going, you know, there may be some changes, but, you know, it is not quite so lively, right? You don't have to make so many changes. So yeah, I think that's a really good point. I really appreciated that. Okay. So, you know, I think I'm going to move to talking about the framing of your book, which is the effective turn, right? And this is kind of the overall, if I understand this correctly, please correct me if I'm wrong. This is kind of the framework of the book, right? The way that you kind of organize all of the many chapters of the book. So how did you kind of come to this framing? You know, was this something that was present in the dissertation? Was this something that kind of you came about after? How did that come about?
Affective turn or the idea that affect and emotions sort of influence a lot of the ways in which we think about and understand and interpret these experiences and how it sort of influence or reinforce some of the problematic discourses of migration. I got that from reading the text and also viewing the films, watching. So because most of the time, some of the ways in which these texts become powerful is because of the way they marshal affects, particularly in the case of narratives about Filipino migration. A lot of these stories, a lot of these films sort of narrate this experience of sacrifice. So, and most of the time, the way sacrifice is taken and to mean something is always towards positive, in a positive sense, it's always in a positive light. So, some of these films operate and work successfully precisely because it draws power from that positivity and even heroicness of heroism of how we frame that kind of experience as sacrifice. So, I think looking at that, to be able to talk about sacrifice more effectively and more richly, you have to look into not just all of those cultural and textual meanings that are under impinge on that term, but also on how it becomes an effective force that makes the film powerful. So, whenever I encounter those kinds of affects, I think what's interesting for me is that most of the time, people don't problematize them. Even scholars of migration don't problematize this term and just take it for what it is. So I think to be able to problematize these ideas, you have to go through those concepts of affect and how affect and emotions are able to sustain this kind and even resolve some of these contradictions. So for example, why is it in many of these stories, why is it considered as heroic to be overextending yourself too much as if it's a positive thing, and how it, and why is it that only women are carrying that burden? So they don't, in most of these films, don't really problematize it. So I think to be able to find those contradictions, find the ways in which these films and this text tries to resolve these contradictions are important. And the only way to do that is to look around, go around this all of the effective terms that floats and sustains these ideas.
Yeah, that's I think what I can't really ask for a better lead-in to talking about some of these chapters. And the chapters are really rich, so let's do it. So, you know, for the first chapter, right, you kind of contrast, you know, two films and then some other kind of works of cultural production, a photographer, right, and then some other things. So, you know, the framing of the chapter, as I understand it, right, is looking at this kind of uneasy relationship between hospitality and being at home, and between intimacy and labor, right, in the through the kind of representations, representations of and representations by Filipina migrant workers, right? So can you talk about how you came to this particular framing for the chapter? And particularly, you know, one of the other threads that you talk about is this kind of idea of guest and host, when a worker is the guest and when she's the host. And so I really love this chapter. I really would like to hear you talk more about this.
Yeah, this is one of the chapters that I really, really enjoyed writing and even rewriting, because I completely changed this from my dissertation, and I was able to update it by using the photography of Sai Sabakani, his really, really lovely short story written by Susi Otomo, an Indonesian domestic worker in Hong Kong. And then I was able to I think in the dissertation, I only discussed Iloilo and another film. I was able to update this this chapter when I came back for research 2 years after I finished my PhD in Hong Kong. And while I was interviewing migrant women workers there, I saw this new film that is being advertised in the city, and it's a new film that is very similar to Iloilo, a Singaporean defended film. So I was able to, that's how this chapter came about. And in the Philippines, what's interesting is that we have these weekly feature shows in which sometimes migrant women work. Migrant women are sort of, they have these really interesting bits about the life of this migrant worker who became successful abroad, who was loved by their employers. That's why they went home, or they were able to, the whole family were able to live in Saudi, or they were able to live in France because of how much their employers loved them. And we, from time to time, we get these kinds of stories, and we and these stories are powerful precisely because they sort of frame as heart touching, and at the same time, it's a good feature story that says that if you are determined and if you do your job well, that means if you love the family that you're working with, then you will have this kind of story. So we get those stories a lot. That's why when Iloilo came out, it became such a powerful film. And in fact, some of the mainstream films here were able to interview the director and find the woman, the real life woman where that story was based in Iloilo, a province here. So it is a powerful story. And I think the reason why it's so powerful is that because it tries to use this notion of becoming a family, that seems to be some sort of, I'm not saying that it doesn't happen, but it's sort of like a fantasy constructed to make you think about how this kind of labor can work in this kind of economy. So I'm very interested in these kinds of stories precisely because they are problematic, but they are also very powerful because they allow you to think about how you can gain a sense of belonging even though you can be perpetual guest, because you'll never become a citizen or a permanent resident in most of these countries that allow you to work there, because of the job that you are doing, precisely because you are a domestic worker, a foreign domestic worker. If you are working in other industries, then you could get a work visa and that would give you a pathway to citizenship or residency if it were any other job. But because it is this uniquely specific job that you are only hired to become a sort of a proto family, a supplementary family, but you'll never be part of the family, is I think what I find really interesting in these kinds of setup that gets to be narrated in these films and in these stories. That's why I look at this theme that cuts across these two films and photography project and this short story. And I try to problematize it. And I think I think the guest host relationship, the idea of hospitality, has been been very helpful in helping me identify some of the things that I find problematic in these stories, but also some of the things that I also find very powerful and very convincing if you were a viewer of these films or either of these short stories. The photography book is about the photographer's life and also in extension, her mother and her mother's employer's life, because they ended up really becoming close. Now, what I find very interesting in the short story that I've discussed in this chapter is that what the author did here was use the point of view of her employer, or the figure, the point of view of the employer, talk about the domestic worker, which I find a very interesting strategy for the writer, because it takes sort of a reversal, sort of a disidentification that that creative writing and fiction allows. So that's how I tried to thread these three texts together. And I was really hoping to be able to bring out and expose some of the ways that make this idea of belonging and alienage a sort of part of a continuum that sustains these kinds of stories.
Yeah, that's a really great, I found this to just be such an interesting chapter. I liked all of the chapters, but I found this just to be such an ambitious chapter, right? I mean, you're really doing a lot with like different kinds of media, and that's also challenging, right? And then to find this kind of through line through, what is, a Singaporean Chinese, right, kind of representation of this, and then a street photographer and an author, like an author who is herself a migrant worker, right? Like that is, I feel like you make it look easy, right? You make it feel like these things kind of naturally emerge. And yet, you know, it's just such a, you know, I just found it to be such a rich chapter. And I hope some of the listeners will check this out because it really is pretty great, in my opinion. So I guess let's move on to chapter. Oh, totally my pleasure and totally genuine. Like, I really enjoyed it. So for chapter two, right, you're talking here about some concepts that are congruent to shame, right? But not entirely shame, right? And you kind of talk about these in terms of the terms, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this correctly, but malu and hiya. As things that you, in fact, don't, speaking of translation, right, you don't translate that. You let it kind of sit in the text as a kind of separate term. And so, you know, in this particular chapter, right, this chapter is organized around, you know, romantic and sexual relations, migrant worker, bad romances, you know, and ideas of romance or, you know, sort of sexual relationships that are kind of maybe straying outside of the bounds of certain things, as well as queerness, right, and queer relationships. So I'm just kind of curious, you know, how you decided to frame this way. How did you, you know, why did you organize this chapter in this way? And can we hear a little bit more about that?
Yeah, thank you very much. I think among all of the chapters, this one is the new chapter from the dissertation. This is completely new from the dissertation. It talks about shame. Malu and hiya are vernacular words for shame in Filipino and Indonesian context. So, and I have to be most careful about this chapter because I didn't want to, partly because talking about sexuality in both of these national contexts are, and especially related to the subjects of the book is, are pretty much a sensitive topic, considering how much, even with different religious backgrounds, these two countries are very conservative. And also because I think while there are certainly a lot of religious discourses that sustains that has to be explored in this chapter, I think that's one of also some of the blind sides of the chapter. I wasn't able to extend my discussion to talk about Catholicism and Islam religion in terms of notions of morality and sexuality, which I find is also, for the project, is no longer part of its purview, and I think something that can be explored further in other studies. But what I'm trying to do here is look at how shame as it relates to the experience of mobility and why so many of these stories, especially when they talk about finding love or when they talk about sexual desires, whether if it's interracial sexual desires or homosexual or same-sex relationship, they are framed they are framed by this term of malu or shame in Indonesian context or hiya in Filipino context. And even when they're talking about, I think one of the things, one of the chapters that I also have been very sensitive and very careful about articulating in this chapter is how migrant women frame the experience or venturing out into sex, because a lot of the stories also talks about that, which I find also very interesting and pretty much underexplored in many of the scholarship of women's migration. And there seems to be a continuity, an interesting continuity with how they discuss the and how some of these stories are framed within that same sexual work of domestic work and sex work. So I think shame here is a very powerful affect. I think this is something that could be explored further. And there are interesting connections with the way Filipinos feel shame to the language of Hiya and Malu in Indonesian context. But there are also specificities with how the experiences, how they express and respond to shame. The most interesting part here in this chapter is the discussion of same-sex desires and relationship. So there were several stories I have to choose, and I was able to choose, I think, the most engaging ones, the ones that talk about shame in both of its moralizing sense and shame in its more ambiguous, ambivalent, and more progressive stances in the fiction and films. So, I think this chapter is definitely a chapter that I enjoyed writing.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. You know, in certain ways, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think it is valuable because, you know, as you were just saying about that first chapter, right, the domestic worker is often kind of bounded by this idea of being like a surrogate mother or surrogate caretaker, right? And that's something in which, you know, often sexuality is absent, right? You're not supposed to have it, right? You're just supposed to be there to care for people. And so, you know, in many ways, it kind of comes out of those things that are bounded by that framework that you kind of introduce in the first chapter, right? It's the all of these other things that are happening, right? All of these other desires for connection or, you know, sort of necessity, you know, that you have to like make connections outside of this particular work site. You know, all of those things are kind of like in the second chapter, which I, you know, I really found to be also really interesting. And, you know, I kind of agree with you in my, you know, the times that I've seen films about domestic workers, that idea is almost always never there, you know, or if it is, it's kind of seen as disruptive. So, okay, let's move on to the third chapter. And so this really looks at issues of vulnerability, right, and kind of precarity. And I, you know, I was really, again, interested in how you organize the text to kind of allow this theme to emerge from it. And then particularly this sort of secondary question, this was a sort of smaller point within the chapter, but I was just so fascinated by, is this kind of idea of taking back time, right? The sort of concept of taking back time through writing, right? The act of writing as a kind of, you know, in and of itself, a somewhat rebellious or, you know, kind of selfish, not in a negative sense, but for the self, right? Kind of activity. So I was hoping you could talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah. Chapter 3 is also in response to some of the assumptions that the fiction written by domestic workers, migrant women, and the films that are about them are only just victim stories. So So in the third chapter, I talk about ideas of victimization, ideas of vulnerability. And I deliberately put this in the middle of the book because I think that's because I wanted to problematize what it means to feel saturated, what it really means to feel saturated and feel that to have that feeling of oversaturation, of victimization when we encounter stories about marginalized subjects, about marginalized speaking subjects. So I talk about the ideas of vulnerability here and how Indonesian migrant women who are also writing are trying to reflect on experiences of vulnerability. And I think implicit in that discussion is that fact that these women are writing. So in a way, they are also negotiating what it means to be able to tell that story, what it means to be able to overcome that experience of suffering, that experience of victimization, and have to be able to negotiate their vulnerability and precarity to be able to write about it. So that it writing in itself here offers them a space, to reflect on those experiences, and that would allow a much richer understanding on the kinds of subjectivity that will emerge in that and the act of writing. Most of the time, even among Indonesian scholars, they don't really, and among Indonesian literati, they don't really recognize some of the aesthetics of these forms of fiction. Until what I was trying my best not to do here is just look at this and read this work in their ethnographic value. So I was trying to look at what sort of aesthetics that may come out of that space of writing that is attached to their subjectivity. And that's why the notion of vulnerability and agency and all of the emotions that are attached to it are very important in the way I try to discuss this chapter, because in many ways I'm also talking about writing from the point of or from the position of marginalization in this particular chapter. Of course, along the way I have to discuss the structures that make and all of these policies that make them vulnerable, that victimize them. But at the end of the day, I was trying to also look at that find a vocabulary of aesthetics that could describe why they are writing and to what end are their writings about.
I really liked that. I think I see what you mean. In my own teaching, sometimes I try to incorporate works by or about migrant workers. I teach things on Taiwan and things on Hong Kong, and they're a very important part. But I have, in trying to find material, often found that it is very victim. You know, the characters are often very abject, or they are just kind of like they're victimized. That's kind of it. And I find that to be kind of unsatisfying, both as a, reader or consumer, a watcher of these things, but also as a teacher, because like, what are we getting out of this exactly? Right. So I do find your kind of ethical considerations, really, really, I certainly sympathize with that. And I also think like, you do a lot more than that, right? I mean, you do a lot more than that, not only in terms of allowing them, to kind of allowing is maybe not the right word, reading them, right? Not just in terms of like, well, this is what they say. Although a lot of those stories are from like a kind of personal perspective or a perspective that's strongly identified with the author. So that's very tempting to do. But then also, allowing for aesthetics, right? Which I think when it's something that it seems sort of like, you know, amateur or naive, you know, this kind of idea of the amateur writer, it's not literary enough, right? Which is in and of itself is such a destructive category. You know, so what's literary enough? And that is so like gatekeepery, right? For lack of a better word, than like, yeah, I know. I found that to just be so powerful, right? This idea of allowing, you know, aesthetics to emerge and to talk about that on its own terms, right? I did find that to be just a very sort of something to a potential model, right, for other literary scholars who are looking at this, you know, not to succumb to, I think, some of the things that are sometimes built into our training to be slightly patronizing. And that's not necessarily our intention, but that's often kind of how we are trained, is to kind of emphasize the avant-garde and things like that. So yeah, I really found this to be another chapter that I got a lot out of and learned a lot from. So I really appreciate that. And I really appreciate your comments here that really speak to a lot of that.
What also, I was also reminded when you were talking about teaching non-Western and non-white literature, is that most of the time we have this tendency of looking at or just trying to draw out all of these social justice themes because they seem to be relegated as readings for that. So I remember what one of the things that I'm doing when I'm teaching Carlos Bolosan's America is in the Heart, for example, is that I make them read just the second part, for example, and I ask them to sort of just trace all of the places that Carlos Bolosan went, all over California and then Seattle. So they were just doing that on Google Map, for example. And then I make them think about what it means to write from this kind of subjectivity in which the main guy, the protagonist, or Carlos Bolosan travels the half of the America by riding these cargo trains, trying to escape the police, chasing them. What kind of subjectivity does that entail for this kind of writer? Just imagine yourself from this place. So you're, for example, the students are sort of just used to traveling by a more convenient means, and then imagine this person, look at the map and look at the places that he's been, and just trying to as just a steerage passenger, stowaway passenger. So that gives you a sense of what writing means, what aesthetics mean for this particular author, that sort of also displaces what you know about how good memoir is written, or how good fictions or good novels or good books are written.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, this is, I don't know why I thought this, but, you know, writing in a freight car, especially in the northern part of the West Coast, right, it gets really cold. I mean, it's cold already because you're going very fast, but it's also just like, you know, what is that like when, you know, even if it's a bus and it's late, right? A bus is usually heated, you know, there are lots of people, right? All of these things. Yeah, it's very, I mean, I think that's a really interesting thing to think about, right? And to kind of incorporate into, right, students' learning and ideas of aesthetics and all of that. So yeah, I think that's such a great point. Okay, let's see. So let's move on to chapter 4. And so in chapter 4, right, you are talking about, you know, and I think really complicating ideas of this kind of, if in my understanding, sort of prevalent image of the overseas worker as the, like, the returning hero. And then, you know, also not only in terms of this idea of the worker herself, usually herself as the returning hero, but the idea of the box, right, the balikbayan box that, like, returns in her place sometimes. So and you frame this in terms of, like, cruel optimism, right? And the kind of the Berlant term. So I'm curious, like, how did you come to that framing? You know, what other thoughts did you have, you know, in relation to this chapter?
I was actually just looking for a way to problematize sacrifice, and just look at it from a perspective wherein we can actually challenge all that makes it optimistic in a way, but still retain that hope, because there's always a sense of hope in why and how these migrants travel and return. So I was trying to look for in a critical vocabulary to be able to reconstruct how we can think of and frame sacrifice. And I find cruel optimism very compelling, because I won't say it is it 100% applies to everything, but I find thinking about sacrifice as a form of cruel optimism already a provocation in itself, just because of how optimistic and how positive sacrifice has always been read and interpreted in the public sphere, in Philippine public sphere. So that's why I was I would think of this kind of relationship as cruel optimism, only because the reason why most migrant women or migrant Filipinos go abroad is to find a better job. But at the same time, that intimacy to that promise also is one thing that's also that intimacy to the promise also presents and reveals and exposes some of the limits of what they're doing and what and the kinds of economic relations that they produce because of those because of their journeys. So I'm looking at this sense of economic dependence. I'm looking at this in sense of unsustainability, but mostly I'm looking at this as a form of hope, as a form of hope that is not sustainable. So, and that might in the end be more debilitating rather than liberating for many of the subjects who, and the Filipinos, many of the Filipinos and Indonesians who think of this as a way to be intimate to the promise of a good life. So, so what I try to do here, aside from reading that, is look at how women in these films and these narratives and these stories were also trying to create a different sense of hope away from what they thought was what would bring them good life. So how they respond to once they realize that the kind of hope that they're pinning on is already unsustainable. So that's sort of what I hope is an extension to what Berlant is saying. Because I think in many ways, people are capable of creating alternative hopes within within this sphere of cruel optimisms we live in. So even just pockets of alternative imagination of what the future may bring. So not just these cyclical notions of failed promises. So, for example, one character here, after realizing that all hope was gone, she was able to just find a bit of relief in staking some of her income or staking some of her savings in this makeshift laundromat. And I think it's no longer connected to the failed promise of migration. It's sort of trying to come up with new alternative imaginaries of hope. So I think framing it as cruel optimism is very important discursively, but at the same time, looking at how the text tries to, the films here tries to conjure a different sense of optimism is also an important part of this chapter.
It's a really, I think, a really nice point. I got a lot out of the framing, you know, of this. And I'm also kind of curious, you know, just to kind of follow up on something. So, you know, I like this idea of like unsustainability, right? This idea that these are, you put it so well. I think this idea of these kind of like, I think you said like failed cycles, right? This just kind of idea that if you keep doing it, it will, you know, you can just kind of keep doing it. And I am kind of curious, like how, you know, how did you decide to kind of look at both the people, right, who are kind of engaging in these cycles, and then the people who are receiving, you know, some of the fruits of their labor, you know, how did you decide to put them together in this chapter? You know, I get the sense that both of them are kind of subject to these ideas of expectation and failed hope, you know, and then kind of a reviving of that. But I'm kind of curious how you decided to put these two things that from an outsider, they seem somewhat, you know, potentially unrelated, and then you kind of weave them together really nicely. You know, how did you decide to do that?
I guess also looking at these narratives and how there's really no way of separating, in at least in the economy of remittances, in the economy of migration, economy of remittances, how the person who leave and the person who are left behind are completely bounded together by this kind of cruel optimistic relationship of this economy of remittances. So it's hard to separate them, and only because you only because they're part of the structure, and to separate them would mean, or thinking about solutions, for example, saying, because the, a lot of the ways this is being discussed, for example, it's a form of solution is, for example, we can teach migrant domestic workers while they are still abroad to with courses of financial literacy so that they know how to save money, or we can tell the family that they have to be financially more independent. And they have to find a ways, find more resources aside from their migrant families. So those are kinds of band-aid solutions. And, because if we disentangle this kind of relationship, if we disentangle the people who are leaving and the ones they left behind, we'll just be able to imagine all of these, temporary solutions. But if you look at them as entangled in this process, as entangled in this kind of relationship, that's probably a one way of moving forward with how to think about this problem.
Thank you so much for that. That was a really great way of tying that together. Okay, so we're coming up on the final chapter, which is chapter 5. And this is another chapter that I don't know if enjoy is the right word, because the subject matter can be very grim, right? But I found it to be a very powerful chapter, right? And you close this with a discussion of a number of legal cases, right? Some of them perhaps successful and some of them unsuccessful, but all of them, you know, kind of addressing pretty serious, kind of serious issues. And then, you know, kind of framing these stories or these legal cases in terms of commemoration and mourning, right? So I guess I'm just sort of curious, you know, how you then connect this to the literary works that you discuss, and kind of more broadly, why do you choose to end the book on this kind of topic?
A lot of the people from my generation, actually, and in the Philippines, one of the most important historical event that inaugurated all of these discourses about Filipinos in diaspora, particularly of migrant workers, is the death of a Filipina in Singapore, is Flor Contemplacion. So that was a very big historical event, and that dovetailed into many of the ways in which we are framing how to talk about migration, nationalism, and how, and all of the cultural representations of diaspora in the Philippines. So in many ways, when you talk about politics of migration, in at least in the Philippine context, we're talking about death. We're already mourning. So I think in many ways, this aspect of the book is very important as it tries to reckon with all of these discussions, all of this politics that has happened, more than, I think, more than 30 years ago already. It's sort of a way to understand, how many of these discussions have been progressing into. And, I like that I tried to end it in this chapter because I also wanted to not just talk about the nationalist framework of migration, because that is how most of, Filipino scholars particularly frame migration as sort of, it only becomes progressive when connected to nationalist agenda or nationalist progressive agenda. And I think more than that, what we're seeing in the past few years, past few decades, is that Filipino migrants are also, because of their mobility, because of their movements, have also started gaining grounds in solidarity work and gaining grounds with the social movements trying to reach out to other nationalities, particularly with Indonesians. So even as I was trying to discuss the whole book, the similarities and parallelism of the experiences of Indonesians and Filipinos, I think in the last part, this is where I was trying to tie them and just to discuss how in many ways, not just their fates are tied, but also their movement. And the social movements can only gain more ground in the future via this transnational solidarity. So, and what we are seeing in these legal cases is that there are transnational solidarity being imagined by both Indonesians and migrant women. And the way they imagine this is also reflected in richer ways in this fiction and films. So I wanted to end it that way, to talk about also the activism, the transnational grassroots activism happening not just in Indonesia and the Philippines, but also in Singapore and in Hong Kong, and hopefully in other spaces where there are also Southeast Asian migrants.
It's a really, I think, a really powerful statement, and I think something that you do really persuasively here. I really did find this to be a powerful way to end a book, especially, you know, when you're writing a book, you basically just kind of want to be done. So I appreciate I appreciate this kind of, you know, really meaningful way to structure this book, right? I found it to be really intentional and for that reason, like very powerful. So thank you. You know, we've taken up a lot of your time. I know it's getting probably pretty late where you are. But I did just kind of want to make sure, you know, is there anything that you'd like to talk about that we didn't have a chance to get to? Obviously, for the listeners, we're only scratching the very, 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 you know, surface of this book. You should definitely read it. You know, there's a lot more here than we've been able to talk about in an hour. So, but in case there is something very important that I haven't gotten to, is there something you wanted to talk about?
I think we've pretty much covered everything, going to chapters one by one. And I was actually able to rearticulate some of the things that I was thinking, because sometimes right after you finish the book and after it went to production stage, you no longer want to think about it. Right? So I'm guessing this is also, our conversation is also sort of sparked some of the ways I was thinking about that book in each of those chapters. So thank you very much.
That's so great. And I definitely, having completed a book recently, also really relate to in that post-production period, never want to, you know, I mean, you come back around eventually, obviously, because you love it. But, you know, at the time, just thinking, oh, I never, you know, if I never think about this, I never, I would be happy, you know. But yes, I'm glad that you were able to overcome this for this interview, because I really enjoyed it. And so I guess the final question, and I think a sort of traditional question for the New Books Network is, you know, what are you working on now? What can we expect for you from you in the future? You know, what are you working on?
I'm planning to go back to writing poetry. So after writing critical essays, I wish I could have time to write poetry. And I was planning to do some research for it, because I'm planning to write about the former military bases where I was when I was growing up. So I plan to sort of write a suite of personal poems that are based of me growing up near Subic military bases. So yeah, that's sort of in the works. So hopefully I'll be able to finish it in the next 2 years. So it's probably the next book that I'll be working on. And then I'm working with another scholar, and what we're doing is we're interviewing migrant grassroots activists to help them. We're helping an organization that I've worked with back when I was in Hong Kong. A large part of the network they have are also migrant activists from other countries. So me and another scholar are interviewing seasoned activists in various places, Filipinos, and trying to sort of rewrite their stories based from that interview. And hopefully it will come out as a book in 1 or 2 years. But yeah, the next few books might not be as traditionally scholarly, but it would also take some research power, so sort of research effort to be able to finish them. So, but I probably won't write another monograph for another few years.
I think that's pretty fair. I mean, both of those projects, though, do sound really fascinating. So hopefully, you know, we will have you back on at some point to talk about these things. But, you know, in the meantime, you know, there's a lot there. I hope at some point we can expect another monograph from you. But at the same time, you're doing a bunch of other things. So I hope you can also have some time to devote to a number of other things that interest you, which I think are quite a lot. I didn't put in your biography that you're also a poet in your own right, but you absolutely are, and you're going to do it. So, you know, thank you so much, you know, for taking the time to speak with me. And I really enjoyed this conversation. I hope to have another one at some point, you know, on one of these other projects in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Clara. Nice talking to you again.